the products that are in those trusts. And so there's danger for the people out there. Now, I have two computers working, one that I read and one that you read. MassMutual wants to make sure that you understand that this is not legal advice that we're giving. I will say that it is not illegal advice. So in spite of their disclaimer, I'm comfortable with what we're talking about. Surveys have shown a very high incidence of non-guaranteed universal life policies that are owned inside of irrevocable life insurance trusts. And that's sort of where the risk is that we want to talk about. Acting as a fiduciary, a trustee may bear legal liability for failure to take appropriate actions to preserve the death benefit of these policies. And so we're going to look at an article that, well, actually three articles that have come out over the last 4 years from Lineberg Information Services that talk about this this problem. Does anybody subscribe to Steve Lineberg's newsletter? Okay, so I'm going to tell you about it. It's called LISI, L-I-S-I, Lineberg Information Services, Inc., and it's the finest newsletter, in my opinion, in the industry. Very well priced. Steve Lineberg is an attorney, a practicing attorney in Pennsylvania, and he was an instructor at the American College for many, many years, the most popular instructor they had. He's created LISI, which brings in contributions from all across the country, and they'll beat everybody. They'll beat NAFA, they'll beat AALU when there's some sort of tax-relevant change that takes place in Congress or from the IRS. So we're going to review this, and then we're going to talk about the pros and cons of replacement from the client's point of view, from the carrier's point of view, and how you serve the best interest of all your clients. The articles that we're referring to, the primary was written by Randolph Whitelaw, who's a managing director of Trust Assets Consultants in St. Louis, and Richard Weber, president of the Ethical Edge in Carlsbad, California. And both of these men have made it their life's work to evaluate policies on behalf of clients. So an enforced policy, is it going to get where it says it's going to go? Or is there trouble? And if so, we want to know about it earlier rather than later. Well, let's review what the purposes of an irrevocable life insurance trust is. An ILIT is just simply an irrevocable trust. So an irrevocable trust is a legal device that's created to hold property for the benefit of someone else. And typically, an irrevocable trust is used when we want to take assets out of a taxable estate, put them in a non-taxable estate, or outside the first taxable estate for the benefit of the beneficiaries. An ILIT is simply a trust who's primarily funded by a life insurance policy because of the terrific leverage opportunities that exist with a life insurance policy. And by the way, if you have questions as we go along, you're welcome to ask. Here's the reason that an ILIT works so great. I've got a $10 million taxable estate. How much of that will be taxable if a person dies in 2011? $8 million. Well, yes, if your husband and wife join together and we do some planning, we can escape taxation on $2 million of that, and we owe tax on $8 million. And what is a marginal bracket? The marginal bracket next year is 50% for an estate up to $10 million, 55% above that. So let's go with 50%. So this client's going to owe tax on approximately $8 million, $4 million of taxes. Now, hopefully you all know that there are devices. Anyone who pays tax on that amount is sort of foolish, because with planning, you can get substantial discounts. You can do family partnerships and that. Let's suppose that we wind up with a tax due of $2 million. If we want to have assets inside the estate to accumulate assets to pay that $2 million tax, how much do we have to earn to have $2 million left?
Probably 10.
Well, it's got to be at least double, because the estate tax is half. But if we paid income tax to acquire that asset, it may be that we have to earn $5 million to wind up with $2 million to pay a tax. That's very inefficient. If, on the other hand, we create an ILIT to hold property for our children, the premium on a $2 million policy, Tom Barnes is going to talk in the next hour, he knows big policies inside and out, two 65-year-olds, approximately the cost of $2 million of protection. Yeah. At that age?
For $2
million. I think it is closer to 20 or 30. So. But we'll go with yours, per year. Well, we've got a very good price policies, Tom. You ought to look into that. I'm kidding. Tom knows.
Tom. 75-year-old for 5
Okay, there you go. So Tom's probably right. Let's say it's 60. $60,000 a year. We have five beneficiaries. We can transfer how much to those beneficiaries each year and not even have to file a gift tax return? 26,000 times five, 125,000 that we can move out of our taxable estate by gift. It purchases the $2 million policy. When the grantors die, $2 million matures income tax-free and estate tax-free, and it's very powerful. So that's the idea of it. Now, the second question is, if the islet now owns the property, the cash from the death benefit, how does that help the executor pay the estate tax on the remaining, you know, the $2 million that still has to be paid? And this isn't like, we're in the big room, I understand that, but people can actually talk in here because I'm wandering. How do we get money from the trust to the executor? One is, the trust can allow the executor to purchase property from the estate. So he writes a check for a share of the business. He now holds that interest in the business that he's going to distribute to the children. The executor gets the cash he needs. It may make sense to loan money to the estate and actually produce income for the trust and have that for some period of time. So the point is, we can make this cash available to the estate to pay the taxes, but in the most tax-efficient manner. Well, lots of this has been sold. Lots of insurance has been sold, and it's out there, outstanding. I'll give you some numbers in a minute. What is a trustee's responsibility with regards to the assets that are put in it? First of all, who is usually the trustee of an islet? So mom and dad have built a successful business. They create this islet for estate planning purposes. Typically, who do they name as a trustee? An adult child, right? And probably the same person who's going to be the executor. They may make mom a co-trustee if she has income rights during the life of the person. So, son, we just bought some policies. We put them in a trust. We need you to sign here, 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 and here. Would you send these documents back right away so we can go? So the son owns it. Did that work, Jan? Or have you been over there yet? Oh, good. Okay. The trustee takes on, under the prudent investor rule, he takes on a fiduciary responsibility. Now, you may all become fiduciaries within the next year by virtue of holding a life insurance agent. You've been following this with NAFA. Tell me what a fiduciary standard is.
Higher than a suitability standard.
Higher than a suitability. I mean, what does this mean? This is why we're going crazy as an industry, because as a fiduciary, does that mean we have to disclose all our commissions on life insurance? Does it mean that we have to make available to the client every single company that they could possibly purchase from? In other words, does it kill the career agency system? The idea that we can sell a policy with one carrier? Now, I happen to believe that if I buy a Lexus or an Infiniti or an Audi or a Mercedes, I'm buying a good car and I'm going to get good value from that. Would you agree? If I buy a policy from New York Life, from Northwestern, from Mass Mutual, from Penn Mutual, from Guardian, are they really going to have a bad policy? So I don't think there's anything wrong with having a preferred carrier. I think that makes sense. We don't know. The problem with the fiduciary standard is that you always know what is right and wrong after the fact. It's always a look back. Why didn't you do this? And any reasonable or prudent investor would have done that. But here's the responsibilities that the trustee has. Choose initial funding for the life insurance policy that is based on a reasonable expectation that the policy will survive the life of the grantor. Maybe a few exceptions for term insurance, but as a general rule, a trust is intended to survive the life of the person who created the trust. This can be accomplished with no-lapse universal life policies funded to the proper no-lapse premium, whole life policies that are based on, a whole life policy, because by virtue, we have overcharged the client. I mean, that's what a dividend is, right? So the client or the company has more than adequate funding to maintain the death benefit for life, or high funding of non-guaranteed products. The second responsibility is the trustee ought to keep track of this with periodic and hopefully annual reviews. Well, and I'm going to use legal language that comes from the people who drafted this. In today's fiduciary environment, conduct must be demonstrated. This person is capable. It must be documented. here's the procedure we use to make the decision to purchase, here's the decision we continue to make to maintain the policy, and it must be affirmed. What does the word affirm mean? Do you suppose? The trustee has to sign off that I have done these things, and to my best knowledge, it's working. How many trustees do you know who do this? How many professional trustees, banks that own life insurance, how many of those are capable of really understanding a policy and the trajectory that it's on? Well, you begin to see the problem. A trustee is not legally obligated to accept a trust, except in a trust or a trust investment that it is not competent to manage. But once the trustee accepts the duty, he affirms that he has the requisite skill and expertise to do it. So if I agree to be a trustee, I'm saying, I'm in. I know how to do this, and I will bear responsibility for that. Hence, trustees contractually perform their duties in a guilty without proof of innocence environment. I'm capable.
Did you make up
that term? No, I didn't, but it's a good one, isn't it? Yeah, quotable. An important thing to know is that a fiduciary conduct is evaluated against a process standard, not necessarily a performance standard, which means that documentation is required to prove prudent decision-making, recognizing that over time, trust objectives, tax laws, economic and market conditions, risk management practices, and life insurance product features change. That was a lot. What is it saying? Here's what I think it's saying. The reason that I appoint a trustee to manage this for the benefit of my kids or my extended family is that I recognize that the best advice that I give today may not be good advice in 5 years because things change. Interest rates drop, policy fees change, and so I want someone who is actively managing this policy to make sure that it stays current to the needs that we have. That's the whole idea of having a trustee. We trust them to take care of those people. Have you all heard of the famous Conestoga wagon case for trust? This is in case law. One of the earliest cases of someone creating an irrevocable trust was a fellow in the Midwest. And in the creation of the trust, he said, I have made a study of every major corporation in the United States, and I am convinced that the best run company in the country is the Conestoga Wagon Company. And so therefore I direct that 100% of the trust assets be invested in Conestoga. Well, as Conestoga, as wagons fell out of favor and Studebaker cars came on the scene, the beneficiaries petitioned the court to allow the language of the trust to be changed. The trustee wanted to change it. There was no language that allowed him to do that. And so they watched a major fortune disappear as the stock value went to zero. The whole idea of his trust is that it should allow for changes as is needed. Well, how do trustees evaluate risk? Mistakenly, according to the authors, they rely on policy illustrations for this calculation. The problem is that illustrations assume a constant interest rate or investment returns and a current scale of insurance charges, whereas market volatility actually dictates the interest investment returns that they receive. So, picture in your mind, well, I actually have a picture in your mind the way that we run a universal life policy illustration. We say you pay the premium and you earn 5.5% per year, and the cash value grows like this, so the risk is going down, and the cash value is going up, and it's great. What does investment returns really look like, particularly if it's a variable universal life, say? It'll go like this. Suppose you had a variable universal life that actually had identical return to that was predicted. Does that mean the policy will succeed? Why would it not? You shook your head, so I'm pointing at you. Well, it may not succeed, and here's why. Do you see the year where it was below the benchmark? Now, the market has 2 years of 100% gains. So at the end of the day, the market has averaged the 5.5% that we built the policy on. But during this period of time, when the person's 88 years old, what happened to the net amount of risk? It went up, and so what happened to the policy expenses? They went up and they clobbered the cash value because of the old age, so that when the market rebounds, it doesn't enjoy it on as much cash value. So do you know what a Monte Carlo simulation is? Anybody define that for me? Tom? Which means, how would we run a Monte Carlo? Yeah, so what a Monte Carlo does is it says, okay, let's suppose that this is relying on a 7% average return. What are the different ways the stock markets could get to 7? Well, one is that it could go up spectacularly in the first 2 years and then be pretty level for the rest of the life. How's this policy going to look? It's going to look really good because we squeezed out all of our risk. It could also go like this, couldn't it? How's this one going to look? Not very good. Or it could do, and a typical Monte Carlo will run 1,000 simulations, 1,000 different ways that the market might get to the end. And they did a study that showed that a policy that succeeded with an average return failed 77% of the time in a Monte Carlo run. Now, this is just important because this is what happens. If we're in a non-variable product, all that happens is the interest rate starts out at 6, and then it goes to 5, and then it goes to 4, and because of the costs at the older ages, it can collapse. But I digress. That's the problem. Does that make sense to you? Okay. Well, a trustee of an irrevocable life insurance trust may elect to do nothing, relying on hold harmless or, and this is a great word, exculpatory language protection. What on earth is that? There may be language in the trust that says, if bad things happen in the trust, you beneficiaries can't go after your uncle who is a trustee. But whatever happens, since all incidents of ownership are conferred on the trustee in order to keep the proceeds out of the grantor's estate, the trustee is the only party who has power to act to protect the beneficiary's interest. And since he or she is the only party who has power to act, who else is responsible? There is no one. And let's take out of the sort of, you know, are the kids going to sue the trustee? The family has lost the money that they were relying on, haven't they? And the purposes that this person created the trust have been frustrated. And that's a negative outcome for everyone, including those of us in the business. Well, here's the nature of the problem. The average total policy death benefit is $1,710,000. The average trust-owned life insurance policy death benefit for failing policies is $3,350,000. Now, how do you suppose I define a failing policy? Tom? Yep. Well, and the way that you know that is when the cash value, when the interest earned on the cash value plus the premium paid is less than the cost of mortality, so that the cash value starts to go down, this is going to start this escalation or cascade of failure because the costs for insurance are going to go up and the interest being earned is going to go down because there's less principal, and it goes like this. It's always a very sharp drop off. Well, hopefully I'm scaring you a little.
Jerry, can you help me understand it just a little better? So the average TOLI policy death benefit is $1.7 million.
Yep.
But the average TOLI policy death benefit for failing policies, so are you saying the first is for policies that are in force and doing well, and the second is for those that are failing? I'm not catching that.
This is good. Thank you, Rob. The first is a universe of trust-owned policies. It includes whole life policies.
Okay.
It includes guaranteed universal life policies where the death benefit is assured. And it also includes a group of universal life policies that are in trouble. Well, if you've got a whole bunch of whole life, it probably has lower death benefit because they're older. And you average all of them together to get the 1.7.
Okay.
But the small section of the universe that was represented in the years when we were selling the non-guaranteed UL,
right,
that has a higher death benefit because those trusts are newer. Did that help? I sort of get the feeling that these guys are the ones who are likely to be the expert witnesses when the litigation takes place, and that that's part of what they're trying to get us to. Well, in general, a trustee is liable to the trust beneficiaries for any losses sustained if the trustee had actual knowledge that a trust-owned life insurance policy was either not suitable for the purpose of the trust or it was not performing competitively with more productive alternatives readily available, and the trustee failed to exercise reasonable diligence in the discovery of potentially damaging trust information that was knowable and and related to his fiduciary obligation. All that's saying is pay attention, trustees. Are any of you guys trustees? I know that for many companies it's a conflict, but one that can be disclosed. Does this cause any anxiety? I mean, as we're having this discussion, it should, because hopefully you have the experience and expertise to do it, but how many of the trustees don't? Okay, well, we're going to get to where we talk about remediation here in just a minute. This is, and we'll sort of step out of the role of following these documents that I'm relying on. What we are saying, this is a quote, are that life insurance trust beneficiaries should expect annual affirmation that scheduled premiums are adequate to sustain the policy to the insured's life expectancy as a minimum, and preferably to age 100 or beyond. Now, Tom is, I hope you don't mind if I talk about it, Tom's going to talk to you about a strategy he employs that keeps premiums low, but the grantor realizes that if claims are, or if experience is adverse, they may have to come up with substantial money in the later years. So it's very well documented as to what's going to happen. I think that that's perfectly appropriate if it's documented and made part of that trust creation process. The policy is performing consistent with its policy acceptance benchmarks and the current trust objectives. The carrier's third-party financial ratings are unchanged or modestly changed. So a trustee ought to have that every single year in their records of what they're doing to manage the trust. If such an affirmation is not provided for flexible premium, non-guaranteed policies, the trustee ought to get a second opinion. So he goes in, he takes over, he goes, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble. Let's get someone to evaluate this professionally. And because the earlier you discover a problem with universal life, the easier it is to crack. It's sort of like Social Security. We all know there's a problem, right? There is no trust fund. It's borrowed money that's now going to be repaid with borrowed money. We've all known it, but nobody's done a thing about it. And so it just gets worse with the passage of time. It is exactly the same in a universal life policy that is not properly funded. Well, what should a trustee do? To maximize the probability of a favorable outcome, the trustee can elect to acquire a guaranteed death benefit policy and transfer all the risk to the insurance carrier. This is my best advice. If you're selling a new one, there is no way that I would ever sell a non-guaranteed UL that didn't have the ability to put a guarantee provision in there, because the policy is now available and they're affordable. A trustee can take on the premium adequacy risk by selecting a non-guaranteed policy, but they then have to monitor it to make sure it's performing well. I think that Index UL falls in this category. Index UL may create great value for the family and for the trust, but you've got to monitor it to make sure that it's living up to its benchmarks, because most of the ones I'm familiar with do not have a guarantee after the first 20 years. It's current values replacing the risk for the policy to survive. If a trustee is unable to implement this type of risk base, then maybe they ought to look at redoing the policy to take on the guarantee. Now, this is one that, if you think about it, it's pretty common sense, but I haven't ever seen it. In addition, when the trust is created, there ought to be specific language in the trust that gives guidance to the trustee as to what he or she should do to see that the policy is performing well, and even more so to give guidance what happens if the policy begins to falter. What ought I to do to take care of that? Well, for example, we come along and we're paying, the grantor is making their premiums every year, they're making their gift, and we find that the policy's failing, the grantor could increase the gift, right? What if the grantor refuses to? What should a trustee do? The language ought to give guidance to the trustee. Should the policy be allowed to run, realizing that it may lapse before the death of the grantor? Should we decrease the face amount of the policy so that the current funding pattern extends the life of the policy? What should we do in that case? Well, if the policy's expected life is 5 years and we know that the grantor has terminal cancer, we're going to keep the current death benefit, right? But if he's in great health, my mom's 92, her mother lived to 105, barring a car wreck, mom's going to live to 105. In that case, we might want to reduce the face amount or look at replacing. Now, at 92, we're not going to replace it. But that's just an example. If the policy is no longer suitable due to changed trust objectives, should a policy exchange or a life settlement be considered? Oh boy, I said life settlements. I think that in some cases a trust may be well served by a life settlement for a policy that's run for many years, the objectives have changed, and the family can get more money. That would be your broker-dealer who would help you decide if that's... Do you understand that life settlements are securities and that therefore they're under supervision? But that may be an appropriate solution. Well, how do they conduct these annual reviews now that we've sort of outlined the problem? First of all, in most cases, there is no annual review. Most companies will now mail a single illustration that says, here's your in-force illustration, but it assumes a current premium pattern, the current interest rate, and the current cost of insurance, right? And they get this one, and I'm not even sure that it gets to the trustee in many cases. Who would it more likely go to? It'll go to the grantor, because that's the person who's paying the premium. And unless there's current records showing the address of the trustee, it might not even get there. Often the trustee generally relies on an agent to provide in-force illustrations. In your opinion, is this an adequate approach? In the author's opinion, it is not. If you do give that kind of advice and service, it needs to be multiple illustrations with multiple possibilities so that they can have that. Yeah? None that I have found. But I certainly think that if, let's imagine a family that's had a policy, a large face amount policy, $4 or $5 million, and the family expects that that'll be paid and the policy lapses. They're going to go after the trustee, but that's their brother. So who are they going to go after next? Now, here's the thing about we agents. We have been collecting renewals. See, renewals are where you come into the line of fire, in my opinion, because it's pretty easy to establish that when you sold the policy and collected the first year commission, that that was good advice at the time. But the acceptance of renewal says that along the way, I am going to continue to provide advice, and I'm going to continue to give you the service that you need to make sure that this policy remains in force. And I think that that's, if I were a lawyer, that's where I would go. Did you collect renewals on that, Tom? Did you give him the illustrations he needed? Did you tell him it was in trouble? If you have the process to show, yes, I did, I talked to the trustee, I sent him a note, here's my letters, here's my file, then that will protect you. But if you don't have that, it could be hard. I sort of want to get to the good part. The authors suggest an actuarial evaluation. Ash Brokerage is one that MassMutual agents work with. There are a number of places where you can go out and get an actuary to evaluate a policy. You send it in, you give them authorization to collect the information from the company. And with this, they can look at it from an objective point of view, tell you if your premium funding is right. If it is incorrect, they can give a suggested course of action to take it. Either the agent must take an active role in providing multiple scenarios, or the trustee should hire an outside evaluator to provide a second opinion. I just listened to a great book. I finished it last night on the way home, called The Big Rich. Anybody hear of it? It's about the four wealthiest Texas oil billionaire families, the Cullens, the Murchisons, the Hunts. Do you remember the Hunts who melted down the silver market? And Sid Richardson. And it just talks about how these families, with all these billions of dollars and personal jets and private islands and all this stuff, how in the second and third generation, they just were fighting each other like cats and dogs. And some family groups would break off and never talk to each other again. Well, this is the sort of thing that we're talking about, frankly. If families go after the oldest brother because he's the trustee who let the policy fail, then you've created a very unhappy situation. Well, so conclusions at this point. When selling a new policy to fund an ILET, it is almost always in the trustee and beneficiary's best interest to make sure that they have a guaranteed policy. They can either pay the level premium to keep it up to date, they can prepay it, or they can underfund it as long as they have a catch-up provision so that later on they can bring the funding to the point so that the policy doesn't lapse. A whole life-based contract, including survivorship whole life. We don't sell a lot of whole life in trusts anymore, but is it an appropriate asset to have in a trust? One of our senior agents, Jim Woodward, has a family, very wealthy family. They have now something like 40 whole life policies in a trust, and they're just cash rich. What would you use the cash inside of a whole life policy for in the case of a ILET? Well, if the wife's an income beneficiary, the trustee does not have to wait until the grantor dies. He or she can make discretionary distributions up to an income of the trust during the life of that surviving or that spouse. Cash value gives you the ability to do that. If we get down the road and the grantor loses his capacity to have the money necessary to pay the premium in a whole life policy, you know, the thing about a whole life, you can get that thing 4 or 5 years old, it's just almost impossible to kill. Would you agree with that? I mean, you can do policy loans, you can use dividends, you can extend the life of that thing. If it's 10 years old, it never needs to die. So that's an advantage. Annual reviews are essential for in-force policy. If the policy is in danger of failing, consider increased premium. Oftentimes, that's throwing good money after bad. Even if you increase it to the maximum, it may extend the life of the policy just a few years. Reduced face amount, I think that's a very good. In fact, in some cases, you can take a reduced paid up and so see what's available on a guaranteed exchange and possible replacement to a guaranteed universal life policy. If you put a guaranteed UL policy in a trust, it's really important that the timing be paid to. I had an agent who just sold a policy a week ago, and he was sort of angry because he got a notice, and on our computer software it said that he needed $10,550.50 to guarantee this if they paid that to 100. So that's what he collected. Well, the actual administration system called for 50 cents more, and so they wouldn't release the policy, and he was really angry. You know, this is a bunch of work. Well, for heaven's sakes, do you really want to fund it at exactly the premium? Because if it's 30 days late, if they go into the grace period, what does that do to the guarantee? It will shorten the guarantee. And so round up, prepay a little bit, build some safety in there, or have a separate account inside the trust that the trustee can call on to make sure the premium is paid in a timely fashion. Does anybody have a good example of a law firm that really gives this sort of guidance to the trustee? I don't know of any. I don't know of any. And are we, I mean, we all have professional relationships with the attorneys. Are we suggesting to them that they ought to be doing this? I don't think we are. And so here's sort of the takeaway from this. I think this would be a great seminar for you to do if you have professional associations with attorneys or CPAs. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Comment? Yeah. They could be. You see, it's America. And if I'm mad, somebody's got to pay. I can sue the trustee. I can sue the agent. I can sue the attorney. I can sue the CPA. God bless the USA. I mean, somebody's going to pay, but not me, right? But absolutely, I think it's part of their responsibility. Okay, let's talk about possible replacement. If a client is insurable and if their current non-guaranteed UL is at risk of failure, then an analysis should be conducted to see if replacement to a guaranteed product is possible and advisable. I think that it's an obligation on the part of the trustee. I think that it's an obligation for the agent. Now, this is language from the state. Replacements are generally costly, with a client losing value by giving up their existing policy. A number of items ought to be considered, as we're going to now discuss. Let me show you a policy. I use this with permission of J.R. Everybody know J.R. Jones or anyone? One of the great human beings on the planet. Oh, I didn't open it. Give me 1 second. I did open it over here. I don't need it on my machine. Sorry, I've got to go over to this one. Okay, this is a policy that J.R. Jones had in force for... He'd had it in force for nearly 25 years. It was one of the first ULs sold by Connecticut Mutual. He's paying $1,058 a year. Oh, no, I'm on the second illustration. Steal my own thunder. Here we go. Now you're going to see Connecticut. So this is a policy. It's been in force for 26 years. The premium outlay is $1,080 per year. This is for a $100,000 death benefit. On the guaranteed side, if he continues that premium payment pattern, the policy will lapse at age 73. On the current side, If he pays that, it will lapse at age 82. He hasn't had anyone in his family die earlier than 82. So is this a good policy to have? Well, so you do the analysis, and now we come down to the one that I want you to see. We go to a current illustration, and he's insurable. We find that for $1,058, what was his premium before? $1,080. So for an extra $22 a year less, we can guarantee the death benefit through age 120. What should he do? I mean, it seems to me pretty clear that because he's insurable, he ought to switch. And by the way, he took my advice, darn him, and he did it himself because he can earn commission. And I didn't think that was fair since I brought it to his attention. It was fair. Okay. Well, if we do an analysis like that, what you want to be sure that you do is you help the trustee to document that all of this is happening and why it's happening. So, this analysis might include specifically why we think it's in the beneficiary's best interest to do the exchange. We need to document whether there were internal exchange options available with the existing company that would have led to a more favorable outcome. For example, could we reduce the face amount and still achieve trust objectives without incurring the new expenses? Could we increase the premiums, take reduced paid up? And then we need to say why it was less favorable to do this type of internal readjustment or exchange. We need to disclose the surrender charges. So I think it ought to be very clear and documented. We understand that in this process we are incurring these surrender charges to move the money to the new policy. Disclose new policy tax and sales charges plus potentially higher insurance charges. And it would be helpful if a credible second opinion were obtained. Now, this makes us crazy, unless we're the ones who arrange for the second opinion. Let's assume a client has a failing UL, they're insurable, and they can obtain new guaranteed coverage. Should you recommend replacement? How many think yes? I'm raising my hand. As a general rule, I think that's right for that client. As an advocate for your client, the answer appears easy. As an advocate for your clients, it may not be quite as simple as you think. Let's take a look. First, the pros of an exchange. Well, a client with a faltering universal life may be putting good money after bad by increasing funding into the current policy. In other words, they may increase the funding and the policy still falls apart. If you can put the same premium or slightly more into a new policy, you could extend coverage to 121. With the new policy designs, a client may actually get a larger death benefit for the same premium, even though they're older. I mean, that's just one of the paradoxes. The trustee is duty-bound to consider alternatives. We've talked about that. Producers may be subject to criticism if they don't make the clients aware of these issues. You know, if you do a replacement, it's going to hurt my persistency, and that will reduce my overall compensation, and so I'll just let it ride. Well, that may be a violation of yours. And a pro that I think is important is producers earn a new commission, perhaps reduced by company rules for the additional work in facilitating replacement. Some of you have companies that will allow you to adjust the compensation rate on a universal life policy. We had an agent, a beneficial in Washington. His name was Ray Adams, character. And Ray, he was like the Grim Reaper for non-guaranteed UL. He replaced them wholesale. But no matter what he did, he always reduced his compensation by 70%, the maximum allowable by the company. And he said, I was paid a commission once. I don't deserve to be paid a full commission a second time. And so by doing that, he was able to reduce the premium the client had to pay or increase the face amount that was available. So consider that if it's your client. What are the potential cons of a replacement? Well, what about the effect on the people who are uninsurable? Now Jerry's stepping on his soapbox. I'm stepping back into my home office role for just a minute. Unfortunately, not everyone who is going to be eligible for a replacement of a policy. So think about this. New York Life, when they first brought out Universal Life, had a policy series called Target Life. A number of us in the room were there when they had that. I bought one from Rob Perry up here at the front. Target Life has its own pool within the New York Life system, and all of us who were in that pool get evaluated based on the interest earned on the investment securing that particular policy series, the expenses the company has incurred, and more importantly, the mortality. And so as I take the healthy lives, the lives that can move easily, I'm taking a healthy life out of the pool. What happens to the people who are left in the pool? Say it. You have an increasingly unhealthy pool, don't you? I tell this story, and not everyone thinks it's clever, but it was interesting to me. We moved here from Pocatello, Idaho in 1984. We took our little kids swimming over to the Riverton County pool. Anybody been there? Well, we're having a great time. We're going around swimming, and all of a sudden, whistles start blowing all around us. I figured that someone was drowning, but no, we all had to get out of the pool. Do you guys experience this where you live? And they cleared the pool, I guess, to look for dead bodies lying on the bottom and make sure it was okay. And we all sit out on the grass for 10 minutes, and then they let us back in the pool. Well, I use that so you never forget my illustration. As we pull the healthy people out of the insurance pool, we have a pool of insureds who are going to die earlier than the pool would without the exit of those healthy lives. The insurance company will pay claims earlier, and the earlier that they paid claims, the less productive that pool is. So what's their only response? Either they've got to increase the COIs or they've got to lower the crediting rate, right? I mean, that's the two things they can do. And so the people who are most vulnerable are left in a pool where their policies are going to have an even earlier decline in value. So that's what happens. Now you say, yeah, that's very esoteric. It is. But stop and think about this. Just 1 minute, Tom. Anybody here have 500 policyholders? Raise your hands. 800? 1,000? We had people of Beneficial with 3,000 policyholders. A New York Life agent had 4,000. As every healthy life he pulls out of the pool is in essence harming the ones that he can't move. Now, this is called an ethical dilemma. A temptation, an ethical temptation, is when we incent people to move because we pay a high commission on moving. That's temptation. That's not a dilemma. But a dilemma is, do I do what's in the best interest of this single policyholder, knowing that it's going to harm the interest of that? Tom?
I'll disagree a little bit.
Okay.
They
might, while it's still in force. And it all works unless they happen to be the one who dies before it would have gone without. Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, really and truly.
15 years.
What?
I missed the interplay between you two for 15 years.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It's okay. I mean, any family-loving billionaire should have the common decency to die in 2010, right? I mean, really, think about it. Steinbrenner did. He's a Steinbrenner, the family guy. Look at the cost of the company. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to help you understand that this is a complex issue so that you don't just go out and wholesale do it. But when we sell a policy, we price a whole life policy with loads, expecting that the policy will stay in force for 20 or 30 years. When we sell a guaranteed universal life, we sell it with a zero lapse assumption. And so we build into it an assumption for what expenses are going to be paid, and the expenses are selling expenses and administrative expenses and mortality charges. Those are the three expenses. Well, suppose that we had a whole life that pays a 55% first year commission plus bonuses and renewals, and it looked like this. 55% year one, 7775. Oh, and then we replace it 55 in year five, 7775, we replace it in year 15, 775, and we do this. What happens to the pricing of policies? It's got to have an effect. Consider the agent.
The carrier that'd have that agent.
Well, okay, so suppose you had a carrier who had no replacement restrictions and the client is willing to change every year. Year one, 55%. Year two, it moves to Company B, 55%. Year three, you know, Mass Mutual's dividend scale failed. Northwestern's better. We really ought to get you to Northwestern. You're there. Next year, oh my gosh, Mass is better now. Now, I realize that I'm pushing it here. At the end of 10 years, what would the result be? Years ago, Security Life of Denver used to run an ad on the back page of the NAFA magazine, and they had this little graffiti. And the one that I loved is it says, definition of financial planning, the systematic transfer of assets into commission. Ooh, that one hurts a little, huh? Well, far-fetched as this sounds, I know people who purchased a whole life policy 30 years ago. They were doing great. And then 20 years ago, they moved to UL because they were paying 12% interest and whole life was languishing at 6. And then, of course, interest rates fell. And 12 years ago, they moved from the UL to a variable universal life because it had a hypothetical return of 12%, and that looked pretty darn good. And then last year, they moved to a guaranteed universal life at 4% interest rate. Well, folks, nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. The cost of the policy, no, you're going to sing it, Rob. At least you recognize it's coming from The Sound of Music. By the way, Mass made me put this on here. I thought that was great. These hypothetical examples are for illustrative purposes only and do not reflect a specific policyholder. But I know some policyholders who have been through this process. What does that do? What does that do for our industry? I mean, you have acted in the best interest of the client to move them into a GUL because their policy was falling apart. But in effect, each time a permanent policy is replaced, we're saying to the client, you made a mistake. The agent sold you a bad policy, I need to fix it. Your insurance company took advantage of you. You made a mistake and can't be trusted to manage a policy on your own. Regardless of what you actually say, this is what the client hears. Is it any wonder that they don't like us? That they're suspicious? Because when Tom comes in and replaces me, or when I go in and replace Tom, I'm essentially said, you shouldn't have trusted that guy, but you can trust me, because I'm watching out for your best interest. Well, is there a happy medium? I think there is. I think you need to explore the alternatives with the client. I think you need to explain to them that they may be able to conserve the existing policy. Here are some common sense rules that I think make sense. Number one, my honest belief is that it almost never makes sense to replace a whole life policy. Now, let's suppose that you have two policies starting day one for a 40-year-old. Right now, Northwestern has a 6.15%. New York Life has a 6% dividend crediting rate. Mass Mutual has a 7. I see this every day. If you were to run them today, we'd have a little higher illustrated value at age 80. Okay? But what's going to happen next year? Well, Northwestern and New York Life took the big dividend reduction this year. They may hold and we may drop. And so that relative position will change. So in a fair fight, we're all going to do about the same. But I promise you this, if you start the horse race where one of them is a quarter of the way around the track with a head start, it's almost impossible for the new policy to catch up. So as a general rule, this isn't a hard rule, whole life policies, just sell a new one and add to the coverage that they already have. If a policy has extensive loans, that may be an exception. You need to look at that, and that's why they have us to make that. Non-guaranteed universal life is subject to much greater risk of inadequate funding, so it takes greater care in the review process. If the existing policy can be rehabilitated, do it. If the client is insurable, consider replacement, maintaining the old coverage until new coverage is approved. Be patient with company commission adjustment rules. They're really there to protect the integrity of pricing, all clients old and new. Even if you can take a policy down the street, that's how we blackmail the company, well, I'll just move down the street. Just know that you're harming your company, and then in the long run, it affects the cause. Don't forget, if you have a troubled policy and the client is uninsurable, so they got $40,000 of cash value left, you can always do a 1035 exchange to an annuity, and you can lock in that cash value so it doesn't decline anymore. And let's suppose they had 100,000 basis in the policy, they've got $50,000 of cash surrender value, can they earn interest and have it be tax-free? They can earn back to basis and it'll go tax-free to the family. So that may be a good option to consider. Well, back to the trustees. All clients deserve good advice, but I think the people that own a trust, the trustees, actually need a higher level of service from us because of this additional care that they or responsibility they carry under the prudent investment rule. I think this is a great opportunity for you to provide service. Jan has told me I have 30 seconds. Which is fine. How do you find these? Well, first of all, look through your book of business and find anything that's owned by a trust. I've got to move this one, I'm sorry. Second, survey your clients during annual reviews and ask if they have policies that are owned in trust or if they're a potential beneficiary of a trust so you can meet that person. Number three, talk with the other professional advisors, attorneys, accountants, and bank or trust departments offer to assist clients with trust-owned policies. Now again, I will make this presentation available to you if you want to use it to go talk with your professional relationships. I think that you could go into the banks and into the to the attorneys and into the accountants, and you could make a case, and in the process, you could earn a great deal of commission doing what's right for your clients. And with that, we're done. I think right on time.